Genesis 39 is the story of Joseph in Potiphar's house in Egypt, where he's sold into slavery, and the attempted seduction by Potiphar's wife. These stories you've probably heard many times. As I try to analyze this passage, I think one of the emphasis is that there is a contrast in the passage. There are maybe two contrasts. The first thing that we could note is there is a contrast between Joseph's conduct and Judah's conduct. Of chapter 38. Remember in chapter 38 that Judah committed incest with his daughter-in-law, Tamar. In chapter 39, Joseph is going to be tempted to have sexual relations with Potiphar's wife, and he will refuse. And I think that's one of the emphasis in the contrast, in the context, the contrast. But there is also another contrast that we're going to see in chapter 39, and it is a contrast between Jehovah's treatment of Jacob, between Yahweh's, which is the tetragrammaton, the four-letter word in Jewish language that became so sacred, between Yahweh's treatment of Joseph and men's treatment of Joseph. I think this is going to be an emphasis because four times in this chapter we're going to read the statement, and Yahweh was with Joseph. See, regardless of what was happening, Jehovah was still with him. Okay? Okay, the theme, or the focal point of the rest of the book of Genesis is going to be on Joseph in Egypt and the bringing down of Jacob and the family to Egypt. And in every scene, there is some distinctive trait of Joseph's character that is highlighted. And in some way, he is being prepared for his great role that he's going to play in Egypt down the way. In this one, he's a very young lad, probably 17 or 18 at the most, and he's sold into Potiphar's house, verse 1. And Joseph was brought down to Egypt, having been sold by his brothers. And Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh, a captain of the guard, an Egyptian, bought him of the hands of the Ishmaelites, which had brought him down thither. And the Lord, notice the spelling, block letters, Jehovah or Yahweh was with Joseph, and he was a prosperous man, and he was in the house of his master in Egypt. The first aspect of the passage is emphasized is the prosperity, Joseph in prosperity. Now, this is kind of paradoxical because he's a slave, and one could ask the question, how could a slave be prosperous? Okay? This runs from verses 1 through 6. Well, we're going to see what the scriptures say about that. The first emphasis in the passage is this emphasis on Potiphar. And there's some things that we should know about him. Verse 1. Verse 1. We're told, first of all, that he was an officer of Pharaoh. An officer of Pharaoh. Meaning he was very closely related in his associations with the Pharaoh, or the head honcho of Egypt. Now, this word that's translated Pharaoh is the word Saris, the Hebrew word Saris. And Saris normally means eunuch in the Old Testament. A eunuch was a male adult who had been castrated. And in the ancient world, the emperors or the rulers of a nation often castrated the men that were nearest to them in power with the express purpose of keeping them in subjection to themselves and keeping them from being a threat to the ruler via a dynasty that they might raise up of themselves. Now, it's possible, since Pharaoh is married in this passage, it's possible that this word also could simply mean a a leader, a sort of a chamberlain, so to speak. Okay? It's a questionable whether Potiphar really was a eunuch or not. That's the issue, because he's married. He has a wife in this chapter. Okay, that does not exclude the fact that he... That does not eliminate that he was a eunuch. He could have been castrated afterwards, see, after he was married and so on. Okay. He is an officer of Pharaoh. He is very close to Pharaoh. Okay? The second thing that we're told about is he was captain of the guard. Now, captain of the guard simply meant that he was in charge of Pharaoh's bodyguards. What would we call that today? He was in the Roman Empire as a Praetorian Guard. He was head of the FBI, whatever you want to call it. He's very, very close to Pharaoh. Okay? Now, in the passage, there's something else that's emphasized. He was an Egyptian. And one would ask the question, why this continual... You would expect him to be an Egyptian, wouldn't you? If he was in Pharaoh's Praetorian Guard, if he was a captain of the guard, a leader, you'd expect him to be in an Egyptian. But it's repeated three times. Verse 1, verse 2, and verse 5. Now, why did the Holy Spirit have Moses to emphasize the fact that Pharaoh or Potiphar was an Egyptian? Well, it may be that you're very close in history to a transition in rulership in Egypt. It's questionable, but it's possible. The threat may have been there. And so the leadership is emphasized to be of that nationality because there's going to be a change in Egyptian leadership. Maybe it would help you and everybody if we went through, parenthetically, the standard Egyptian chronology. Okay, this is a standard Egyptian historical chronology. About 300 B.C., there was a scribe in Egypt. His name wasn't Menes, because Menes is the name of the first dynasty, but it begins with an M. I can't remember it. Anyhow, this scribe claimed to have recorded every king's name from the beginning of Egyptian history and the year in which this king reigned. And that document, I don't know when it was discovered, but it became available to modern scholars. And they have tried to build the chronology of Egypt around Manetho. That's it, Manetho. That's the guy. Around Manetho's chronology. And that's the only document there is. What if Manetho was wrong? See? So, really, Egyptian history is a guess. And if you get a historian who tells you that, then you can put some confidence in what he says. It's a guess, and particularly the chronology. And within the last 20 years, there have been two men who have challenged Manetho's dates and would upset the whole Egyptian chronology, and hence the whole chronology of the ancient world that you read about in ancient history textbooks. But anyhow, this is the standard Egyptian chronology based on Manetho. You have from about circa 3100 to 2700 B.C., you have a nation in cultural adolescence. Okay. But around 2700 B.C., we have the emergence of what is known as the Old Kingdom. This runs from circa 2700 to 2300 B.C. Okay. Now, this was a classical age. This was the age when the pyramids were built, when the Cheops pyramid was built in what's the name of the place? That's escaped. Forget. Anyhow. The kingdom was united under Menes. For a long time, Egypt consisted of the northern kingdom and the southern kingdom, but Menes managed to unite it and so on. They developed the solar calendar. They had medicine, physiology, hieroglyphic writings, majestic art. The capital was at Memphis, where the Giza is the pyramids. Yeah, where the Sphinx and the Giza pyramids are built. Now, when you, if you were go on a trip to Egypt, as you go down the Nile, you follow the history. The ancient capital was up near Memphis, near Giza, where the pyramids are. And then as you move down, you go from the Old Kingdom to the Middle Kingdom to the New Kingdom, see? Till finally you get down by Khartoum. Okay? Okay. Around 2200 BC, there is what is called the first intermediate period in Egyptian history. There is sort of a takeover. The monarchy is superseded by another body of persons, and that lasts for about 150 years, and then the Middle Kingdom begins. The Middle Kingdom runs from circa 2050 BC to 1800 BC. Okay. The pharaohs of this period never recover the same majesty and power that the Old Kingdom had. The capital is moved from Memphis to Thebes. You're still in Upper Egypt. But the priesthood grew stronger and stronger, and hence this is a period when there's a lot of temple activity and so on. Now this period's important to us because this is the period when Joseph goes to Egypt, and it's also the period when Jacob goes to Egypt. Now we know when he goes to Egypt, 1876 BC, and we could compute when Joseph went. Joseph was there some 11 years before them, so he's there about circa 1888 BC. 11 years, was it? He's 31 when he stands before Pharaoh. We'll say circa 1890 BC. Okay, now let me show you something. When this Middle Kingdom ends, it ends by an invasion of the Hyksos kings. The Hyksos invasion. And you have the second interlude in Egyptian history. Second intermediate period. It runs from circa 1800 to 1570 BC. Okay? And in 1570 BC, you have the opening of the book of Exodus. And there arose another pharaoh who knew not Joseph, Ahmes the First, and the 18th dynasty in the Egyptian pharaoh lineage begins. See? And you're way down in 1570. Now, these Hyksos were Shemites from the Fertile Crescent. And hence, they were very kind and generous to the Jews, because the Jews were Shemites. See, they were both foreigners in Egypt. Now, let's finish. This is of interest to us. We'll highlight that. But let's just finish the chronology. The New Kingdom, begins in 1570, circa 1570, and runs to 1150 BC. Then you have total collapse. This is the time of empire. Egypt rises to its maximal strength militarily, economically, politically, geographically. Thotmes the Third invaded Palestine 17 times, just went in and just wiped out cities each time he went. He was softening up, really, the land of Palestine for the Jews. He didn't know it, but God was using him to do that. Amenhotep III is the pharaoh of the Exodus, and he's followed, of course, by Amenhotep IV, whom we know as Akhenaten. This is a time of empire. The illustrious magnificence of Thebes is established at this time. Temple of Karnak and so on. Okay? Okay. This is when the Exodus begins, very shortly after this. The Exodus is in 1446 BC, about 130 years after this. And that's, of course, of interest to us. But anyhow, this period is where we're... Now, draw our line across here. It's possible that Genesis chapter 39 emphasizes the fact that Potiphar was an Egyptian simply on the basis of the fact that this Hyksos takeover might have been very near. See? Nobody knows for sure exactly when it began. I've read dates from anywhere from 1850 all the way to 1780 for the Hyksos beginning of power. But it may have been that they had been very close. Okay? So let's go back to our passage. Potiphar is the first emphasis in the context. He purchases Joseph as a slave. Joseph, as we said, was a very young man and very well built, we're going to say. Handsome and strong. He was both physically, let's see, he was, what's the guy that played Superman? Reeve, was his name? Reeves? You don't follow that kind of thing? All right. He was well built and handsome too. All right, we're going to find that out. And here he is, whether they put him on an auction, slave auction block, or whether they just sold him privately, we're not told. But he buys Joseph as a slave. Okay? All right. The second emphasis in the passage is the fact that Jehovah blesses Joseph. Okay? Verse 2. Now listen to this. And the Lord was with Joseph, and he was a prosperous man, and he was in the house of his master, the Egyptian, and his master saw that Jehovah was with him. Okay? Now there is your key statement. Yahweh was with him. Yahweh was with him. That will be repeated in verse 3. Well, you have it in verse 2. 3, 21, and 23. And this is what I think the theme of the whole paragraph is. Yahweh was with Joseph. And apparently, Joseph was very conscious that Yahweh was with him. And he must have gave verbal testimony to Potiphar, because we're told Potiphar saw that Yahweh was with him. See? And that Yahweh prospered him. In verse 3, we have a very strong verb at the end of the passage. And that the Lord made all that Joseph did to prosper in his hand. Okay? The statement simply, this is one of the places, I think this is the first place we found the King James, might be wrong about this, to translate a hifil stem like it should be translated. Causative action. See? Yahweh caused all that he did, this is Joseph, to prosper. Okay? This verb is a hifil stem. Causative action in Hebrew. In Hebrew, if you want to, there's an action slot. It's not like Greek. It's different, in fact, in its entirety. You have the concept of an active verb, just a simple action. You have a concept of a causative action, that the subject causes something to happen, and that's the idea in this passage. Everything that Joseph did, God caused it to prosper. So, we have an interpretation, then, of that word prosper. See? And the word prosper is exactly what the normal American would think of prospering. He was just successful in all that he did. So what Potiphar is going to do is transfer into his hands all the authority in his house. He'll take care of the books. He'll take care of the functioning of the home. He'll take care of the business. He's going to slowly work Joseph in to being the major domo of the house. Verse 4. And Joseph found grace or favor in Potiphar's sight, and he served him. And Potiphar made him overseer over his house, and all that he had he put into his hand. And it came to pass that from the time that he had made him overseer in his house and over all that he had, that Jehovah blessed the Egyptian's house. So we have the second emphasis. Yahweh blessed the Egyptian's house. Why? Keep reading. For Joseph's sake, or because of Joseph. That's what you call vicarious blessing. We had the same statement about Laban, remember, with Jacob. Now, the concluding statement in verse 5 reads, and the blessing of the Lord was upon all that he had in the house and in the field, meaning that every aspect of that household, whether it was in the agricultural area outside the house or some business area in the house, God just simply caused it to prosper, and it was for Joseph. So Pharaoh, in verse 6, we're told, he left all that he had in Joseph's hand, and he knew not aught that he had. He had so much that he didn't know how much he had, save that the bread that he did eat. And Joseph, well, we have to stop right there, but that verse should end right there. In other words, Pharaoh recognized that Joseph was a unique person. He was industrious. He was sober. He had sobriety about himself. He had integrity. He was faithful. Christians usually make a pretty good employees if they're at all involved with Christianity. That should be typical of all Christians. This young man was very unique. He was very capable, okay, mentally and in terms of handling this man's house. So the first paragraph emphasizes Joseph's prosperity at the hand of Potiphar, but because Jehovah was with him, see? Okay. The second paragraph now, we're going to have some problems. We're going to have a little peril. I just made these P's up to show you I could do it too. Joseph in peril. How's that? Okay, this paragraph runs from 7 through 12, verse 7 through 12. And of course, the peril that he's in is with Potiphar's wife. Now, the latter part of verse 6 should be part of this paragraph, Joseph's description, physically. Okay, we look at the latter part of verse 6b. King James says, and Joseph was a goodly person. Oh, what a poor translation. And well favored. You know what that says? That said Joseph was well built. Joseph was well built and handsome. In other words, he didn't only have muscles. He had muscles and he had a face that you could stand to look at. He was a handsome guy. Okay? Black-haired Jew, big bone cheeks, strong nose, strong features, good thick beard, manly-looking guy, see? Probably 6'1" around there. Interestingly, this same thing is said of David in 1 Samuel. Same statement. Chapter 16 and verse 12. Same thing. Okay? So, here's a young, attractive man in the household, and possibility that Potiphar was a eunuch, that he was castrated. Possible. Whatever. Mrs. Potiphar takes a liking to this young man. Came to pass that after these things that his master's wife cast her eyes upon Joseph. You get the picture? You see the Egyptian eyes with all that makeup on them, you know? That's where it started, gals. And we didn't have the Egyptian display, did we, in college? We got left out, didn't we? We went to Seattle and Chicago, Dallas. Well, if you get a chance to see that, you want to see that thing. That's fantastic. They have all those things from Nefertiti. Nefertiti has the blue eyeshadow on, or she has the mirrors with jewels in them so she can look at herself and so on. Well, anyhow, this is Potiphar's wife. She's rolling those big Egyptian eyes at Joseph. And she's not very modest at all. She just says, she believed in sort of the direct approach. She said, come lie with me. Now, it took a little time for this to happen. I mean, it really didn't just happen that way. This is sort of a summary. Now, try to project yourself as an American male of 1978 into Joseph's, well, let's see, we're 79 now, 1979, and I'm trying to forget tomorrow, you know, is the big day. I get the most unique cards from this fellowship. I got one card that said, for my birthday thing, we looked all over for this card, and then when you open it up, it has great big letters. It's hard to find a card that one your age can read. I get no respect. I just get no respect. Where was I? Oh yeah. This is sort of the goal of our society for something like this to happen, you know. And I'm not too sure it wasn't the goal of that society back there either. This sexual problem has been going on ever since the fall, you know. I mean, so, you know, illicit sex is not something new. So, you know, why get shocked in a sense about it? It's been going on all the time. Well, we have Joseph's response recorded in verse 8. But he refused and said to his master's wife, behold, my master wotteth not, he doesn't know what is with me in the house. And he hath committed all that he hath into my hand. He's made me, he's put me in charge of this house. There is none greater in this house than I am. And apparently, you see, a number of years had gone by for this before this happened. This didn't just happen overnight. Potiphar wasn't an idiot. But a number of years had gone by, and Joseph had emerged and risen above all the servants in that house. Some of them had been there maybe a lifetime. And here he is in his very responsible position, and he takes it very serious. So he says, boy, there's none in this house, verse 9, greater than I. Neither hath he kept back anything from me but you. Why did he keep you back from me? Because you are his wife. How can I do this great wickedness and sin against God? There's two things involved there. In the passage, we have Joseph's description. Then we have Mrs. P's advance. And then we have C, Joseph's response. And two things are involved in his response. And these two things indicate how he was thinking, where his think was, see? What Joseph's think was, okay? The two things were these. One, respect. Respect for his master, Potiphar. He had a good relationship with this man. It was open. It was above board. And God had blessed it. It had been a very successful thing. And he says, how could I do this wickedness against this man that I'm so closely associated with? But deeper than that was a concept of sin against, now watch this, the personal God. The personal God. Or the God that was personal to him. This is the difference between a believer and an unbeliever. I don't care what dispensation you are in. A believer has a consciousness of a personal relationship with God. And the more doctrine that he knows, the more information that he has, the deeper becomes that consciousness of his personal identity with God. And that theology, that input of his identity with God in his own mentality begins to protect that person, you see? It begins to cause his mind to function in a certain way. Look, the rational, Joseph could have rationalized himself right into bed with his woman just like that. Wouldn't have taken much rationalism. He could have said, boy, poor me, here I am. I'm the only Jew around down here. Nobody, no other Jew will know that I've sinned like this. I mean, they're not going to find out. Potiphar won't know. He's not around. Servants won't know, and if they do know, it doesn't matter. Nobody would know. He could have said, well, I didn't ask for this. She asked for it, so, you know, I'll go along with it. Moreover, Potiphar may be failing her as a husband. After all, it's his responsibility to take care of her sexually, and maybe he's not doing that. Maybe I should serve her in this case. I mean, what difference would it make if I did it? Right? You can rationalize yourself into sin so easy. And I think we do that when we do sin most of the time. We just rationalize ourselves right in it. And maybe one of the greatest provocations that could have been Joseph's lot would be, poor me. I don't even belong in this country. And I need somebody to give me attention. And here God sent this woman along to give me attention. Which would be the greatest rationalization in all. You sort of put it in the hands of God and say, oh, God gave her to me. No, that's kind of beautiful the way he handles it. He didn't call it lovemaking. He didn't say, I'm going to have an affair. He didn't say, well, I'll practice a little permissiveness with affection. Instead, he calls it a great crime and a sin against God. Oh, we have another thing, by the way. This is clear even before the law. See that? It is clear even before the Sinaitic law was given that adultery and fornication was a sin against God. Why was it clear? Because ever since the fall of man, God made it very clear that marriage is a divine institution that is to be respected by believer and unbeliever alike, and fornication and adultery is a sin against God. It's always been a sin against God. And Joseph knew that just as clear as a bell. So he calls it what it is. And then that begins to help him in his mentality, in his thinking process. Okay? Okay. Let's go on. And then I'm going to show you some other things about Joseph. And it came to pass as she spake to Joseph day by day. Now get the picture here. Gee. Day by day she's coming after this guy. That he hearkened not unto her to lie by her or to be with her. He began to shun her. And it came to pass about this time, verse 11, that Joseph went into the house to do his business, and there was none of the men of the house therein. And she caught him by his garment, saying, lie with me. And he left his garment in her hand and fled, excuse me, and got him out. Now the sinful desire that this woman undoubtedly called love now led to sinful hate. Hell hath no fury like a woman scorned. Verse 13, and it came to pass when she saw that he had left his garment in his hand and was fled forth, she had incriminating evidence in her hand, she called unto the men of her house, spake unto them, saying, now watch her appeal, verse 14, see, he hath brought in an Hebrew unto us to mock us. Now the use of the title Hebrew kind of indicates that there was a latent jealousy in this household relative to Joseph. After all, he had only been there a short time, and already he was the head of all the other servants of the house. And so she appeals to this jealousy, this envy in her servants. Potiphar hath brought in this Hebrew to mock us. He came in unto me to lie with me, and I cried with a loud voice. And it came to pass, when he heard that I lifted up my voice and cried, that he left his garment with me and fled, and he got him out. And she laid his garment by her until his lord, or until Potiphar came home. The upshoot of this is, of course, that Joseph is going to be put in prison. And this incriminating evidence in verse 13 becomes part of that issue, verse 13 through 23. We now have the basis for judgment of Joseph by Potiphar. Verse 17, "And she spake unto him according to these words, saying, The Hebrew servant," now she repeats it, "which you hath brought unto us, came in unto me to mock me. And it came to pass, I lifted up my voice and cried, that he left his garment with me, and he fled," excuse me, "he fled out." So Jacob is a victim of slander. Okay. He's not been the first person that's been a victim of slander, but nevertheless, it's a clear case of false accusation. So Potiphar's reaction is expressed in verse 19. "It came to pass, when his master heard the words of his wife, which she spake unto him, saying, After this manner did thy servant unto me, that his wrath was kindled." It really says that he lit up, so to speak. He really got hot under the collar. But we're not told who was the object of his wrath, or his anger, or his lighting up. It's possible that she was part of it, but there was not much he could do with her, and he was sort of had his back against the wall with what he was going to do with Joseph, so he had to put Joseph into prison. But interestingly enough, he does not put him in the common prisoner's prison. He puts him in with the king's prisoners, verse 20. "And Joseph's master took him and put him into the prison, a place where the king's prisoners were bound, and he was there in prison." So, he is put into political prison. Now, it happens to be that Potiphar is in charge of this prison. Okay? Will you compare chapter 40 and verse 3, the next chapter, when Pharaoh gets angry with his the chief of his butlers and the chief of his bakers, he has them put in prison. Now watch. "And Pharaoh," verse 3, chapter 40, "put them," that is the chief butler and the chief baker, "in ward in the house of the captain of the guard, into the prison, the place where Joseph was bound." Okay? So there's a little subtlety there which kind of indicates, or possibly indicates, that maybe Potiphar was being at least a little bit lenient with Joseph. See? Put him into a special prison. Now, I don't want to make it appear that he had an easy deal there, because he really didn't. Psalm chapter 105. Would you look at Psalm 105? There are about five chapters in the Old Testament that are sort of running commentaries on Hebrew history. They just sort of run the gamut. And when you look at these, you often pick up little threads of the happening that you don't have in another passage. And here you pick up one about Joseph in prison. This is a reference to Jehovah sending Joseph to Egypt, verse 17 of Psalm 105. I'll start reading at verse 17. Verse 19 is the passage. "And he," Jehovah, "sent a man before them, even Joseph, who was sold for a servant or a slave, whose feet they hurt with fetters. He was laid in iron." Then the next passage, verse 19, that's the verse we want, verse 18. "He was laid in iron," that is, he was put in chains in that prison. So it wasn't an easy deal. The next verse should read more literally, "until the time came that the word that he gave was proven, and the word of the Lord proved him to be true." That is, about his prophecies relative to the butcher and baker, and then he's going to get out of jail. We're looking at the passage, though, to highlight the fact that he did not have an easy time. He was put in the chains. Okay? Okay. Verse 21, we now have a repeat of our key statement. But Jehovah was with Joseph. Yahweh was with him. You know, there is just nothing to replace in life the consciousness of the presence of the Lord with a person, with a believer. The fact that you know the Lord is with you. There's just something about that that gives life a whole new, a totally new dimension and a new perspective. And one of the reasons that I think we read very little, in fact we read nothing, about Joseph's complaining is that he apparently was conscious that Jehovah was with him. He is going to be in this prison for at least 2 years. And we read nothing of his mental attitude at that time. No negativeness, no self-pity. I'm sure he had some because he was a human being, but you don't read about it. It's not recorded in Scripture. He apparently was very conscious that the Lord was with him. So look what happened. He begins now to prosper in prison. And Jehovah was with Yahweh was with Joseph, verse 21, and showed him mercy and gave him favor, just like he gave him favor in Potiphar's sight. He now gives him favor in the sight of the keeper of the prison. And the keeper of the prison committed to Joseph's hands all the prisoners, so he becomes head of the prisoners. Joseph apparently was not a little apple. He was a big apple. He had a lot of capability about himself. He not only was pleasant to look at, but he had a lot of moxie in his head, and it became apparent, see? I don't know if you've ever heard that story about the little apples, the little apples complained to the farmer that they were always on the bottom of the bushel and the big apples were always on the top. And so the farmer says, okay, he says, I'm going to see to it the next time I load up the baskets of apples, I'll put the little ones on top and I'll put the big ones on the bottom. So the farmer saw to it that all the little apples went to the bottom of the bushel and the big ones were on the top. He put them on the cart and got on the horse and started carrying the driving the cart to town, and the old cart started jostling around, boom, boom, hitting bumps, and pretty soon the little apples started shaking up and down, and the big apples that were on the bottom started shaking, and pretty soon the big apples came up, started coming up to the top, and all the little apples shook down, shook down, shook down, and by the time he got to town, all the little apples were on the bottom. The big apples were on the top. The same jolts and bumps in life that caused the little apples to go to the bottom caused the big apples to come to the top. It's the adverse things in life. It's the negative things that happen to us in life that teach us what we really are, that show us whether we have any character about us. I've always admired journeymen, whatever technician they're in, a journeyman who can do a lot of things without having, you know, all the tools. He can still do some masterful work. He's learned how to get along. He doesn't have every little convenient tool on the market. I've admired men like that. It's the things that are negative and challenges that teach us whether we have any character about us. And here is Joseph under terrible duress, a foreigner, a young man at that. And yet he emerges as a leader wherever he's at. Well, there's good cause for that. And one of the major causes was that Jehovah was with him. So Joseph here now, he's in jail. And he becomes the... Joseph heads up the prison program. All right, you guys. Let's get out there and break those rocks. Do a good job. Keeper of the prison committed to Joseph's hand, verse 22, all the prisoners in the prison, and whatsoever they did there, he was the doer of it. The keeper of the prison looked not to anything that was under his hand, because Jehovah was with Joseph. And what he did, now we have the hifil stem again of this little verb, salak, Whatever Joseph did, Jehovah caused it to prosper. And what was Jehovah doing with Joseph? He was taking Joseph through these experiences to prepare him for the great job of being the prime minister of Egypt that was ahead for him, 2 years or, well, a little over 2 years down the road. Okay? Look. So what you have in this passage is something like this relative to Joseph. You have three yokes for Joseph to bear around his neck. One, slavery. Not too good of an occupation in terms of self-image and ego. A slave. Two, temptation from a voluptuous woman. Not too easy to bear for a young 19-year-old strong Jewish lad. Okay? Third, slander. Slander so bad that he went to prison. Every one of those is a tough thing to bear for a young man. Okay? Now, all of those could have been stumbling blocks. Okay? But instead of them being stumbling blocks for Joseph, they merely become indicators of what kind of character he had. Instead of this, the answer to that is no, they weren't stumbling blocks. What did they do? They proved his, one, integrity. He could be trusted. He could be trusted with a man's house. He could be trusted with a man's wife who had eyes for him. They proved his integrity. And because that is true, they promoted his growth, his personal growth. Instead of his self-image being hurt, his self-image was furthered so that he could really produce in whatever job he was in. Okay? And they prepared him for the future. Don't you know that somewhere down the line, Joseph got the opportunity to tell somebody in authority his side of the story with Potiphar, his wife? I'll just bet that down the line he got to vindicate himself in that matter. Okay? Okay. Bible says it is good for a young man to bear the yoke in his youth. In his youth. Now, when you get old, it's not too good. When you're young, it's okay. Okay? Okay. Joseph's secret, or the secret of his success behind him, was the presence of Jehovah in his life. I like what these stories that we're moving into, because they really are character type builders. Any questions on the passage we could try to answer? Next week we have a story of the butcher and the baker, which Joseph's capacity to interpret dreams, which prepare him, of course, for an entree to Pharaoh. Shall we close in prayer? We thank you, our Father, for this magnificent illustration of the presence of the Lord with a believer under very adverse circumstances, and of the responsiveness of that believer to your presence, and of the success that it brought. We ask that God, the Holy Spirit, will be pleased to help each of us apply this passage to our lives, to give us strength and edification where needful, in Christ's name. Amen.